Greetings, Goombas. Welcome to this episode of Long Coat Mafia Podcast. Sorry I'm sound mentally clouded and kind of far away. I'm trying to get over a cold and hoping it doesn't become anything worse. Due to some guests dropping out at the, not so much the last minute, he had some work obligations that had to come up today, so I asked my buddy Lloyd to fill in for the day for the recording. We'll be talking about music, not music again. We'll be talking about movies today. And also in the room today is his fiancée, Michelle. We'll probably be picking on her, and you'll be hearing randomly what the fucks from her, because she's reading a Ripley's Believe It or Not book. So, and if we get one isolated, yes, they'll be put in the intro. Don't think it hasn't happened before. Just ask one of our other hosts. Yep, one of her sound drops is in our intro.
Can I smoke in here?
No.
Fucking mess.
I can isolate that. So, where do we begin?
What's your favorite movie of all time if we're talking about movies? Obviously, everybody thinks, people say their favorite, but you know, there's always a list. But what would you categorize as one of your favorite movies of all time, and why?
For me, that's kind of very hard question to answer. I don't have that particular movie. It's usually all over the place. I can't really narrow it down like I can with music, where you can say what's your favorite artist, what's your favorite band. For me, that's very hard to do.
I don't think it's that hard. What movie do you think you've seen? I know what movie in our conversations you talk about the most or make reference to the most. I mean, obviously that could be because I love the movie also, which is Monty Python and the Holy Grail.
And that's the thing, a lot of a lot of people who grew up within our generation grew up watching Monty Python on PBS for the most part. Then they moved the series to Comedy Central. But it was always a treat watching those movies. It's the most fun. It's one of the most quotable movies out there.
Yeah, right. I mean, I love Monty Python. Like you said, dude, I mean, I'm a tad bit older than you, not a lot. But that was one of the things me and my dad, a few things I should say that me and my dad had in common was we both love British humor, which, as you well know, so hard to get and follow. A lot of times, because of the accents, you really don't even know what they're saying. And the fact that they just throw so many random things out there, Monty Python, just being, you know, with the troop atmosphere, you know, a little different than, like, Benny Hill. I know we're supposed to be talking about movies, but
yeah,
we're going to talk about
it's almost in that different side of the same coin, so to speak.
Yeah, but and you know, once they started putting out movies, I mean, I had to see them. I mean, because like I said, it's me and my dad. We didn't have a lot in common. I mean, I love sports. You know, we both love music. I mean, you know, my dad passed away, but he loved music as much as me, but he was pretty strict on that. You know, now it's called classic rock. Of course, at the time, we just called it rock. Well, obviously from our talk before, previous talk on your podcast with music, I'm all over the place, you know, except for country. But when I found something, you know, me and my dad had in common, just kind of went with it. When I found out Monty Python was making movies, you know, you kind of have to see them. What are they going to come up with next? I mean, you know as well as I do, there are parts of the movie where, you know, kind of enjoy that fast forward button because they dip into that ridiculous animation stuff that Yeah, it's funny the first time you see it. I don't want to see it the second time, so I kind of fast forward through that. But
see, with me, it was when I was young, it was complete opposite with my father. It's like, I'll let my son watch Benny Hill, but not Monty Python. But when it came to almost movies, it was Clint Eastwood's on. You know, that he was almost at tail end of that tail end that it was Eastwood was just coming up and John Wayne was just starting to die. His son was setting on his career almost, and Eastwood was starting to rise. Mm-hmm. And it, with Eastwood going from spaghetti westerns to action movies, he was in that vein following that line, and therefore me growing up in that era of the westerns going the way of the dodo, so to speak, and the action movies coming out, it was sit right down,
right.
Watch, you know, Clint Eastwood, you know, watch what was the other one? Yeah, they were all cookie cutter back then. It was Death Wish.
Eastwood, Charles Bronson.
They were all, you had cookie cutter movies like that in the 80s. Especially with horror, it was always cookie cutter. Same storyline, you had to watch them because there was something about them that made you want to watch them that appealed to everybody.
Yeah, well, I think, I guess you probably can, you know, as far as, you know, with the Westerns being so popular, because that wasn't my dad. My dad wasn't much of a movie guy, and he didn't watch a lot of TV. I think that's why, you know, we bonded with the British comedy Monty Python. He loved Benny Hill too. Kind of comedy in general. I remember my early teens, mid-teens, we used to be able to, that's when we first got cable. There was cable around. We as a family didn't have it until I was...
Pin that for a second. Let's explain something for the younger generations that are listening. Back, me and Lloyd were kids. Especially in the 80s, the places that actually had cable were big cities like Detroit, Chicago, New York City, maybe Boston, LA, big cities. But the suburban areas didn't get cable until maybe about 82. And still then, it was still limited to maybe about 30 channels.
I think when I grew up here in Martinsburg, West Virginia, for those listening in other parts of the country, small town, about an hour and a half, hour 45 minutes from the nation's capital. But I think it roughly had 50 to 60 channels. But you had to remember, even when cable came out here in Martinsburg, you couldn't afford it. A lot of families couldn't afford it. You know, if you had some friends that, you know, were a little better off, you know, parents had more professional type job, doctors, lawyers, things like that, you get to go to their house and watch it. But, you know, I grew up, my dad was the only breadwinner in the family, you know, five kids in the house. So, you know, there was cable in Martinsburg, just we didn't have it. And so, you know, we were limited to
I'll call them the vowel channels, which is you'll have five channels and sometimes a sixth.
Depending on how clear the weather was.
Yeah, and what I mean by that, if your kids are smart enough, you know your vowels are A, E, I, O, U, and sometimes Y. And when I was living in Florida for a little while, we couldn't afford cable. We were that poor, broke. And Florida being one of the flatter states in the union, so to speak, you could still have a TV antenna and get five stations and sometimes a sixth. But growing up, we had cable because my father worked for AT&T, and he was making damn good money for Ma Bell. So we were able to have cable in, as you know, that during that time frame, the UHF channels again, for the young crowd, the ultra-high-frequency stations, which were what would be considered a few years ago the independent stations.
Right.
Lloyd might know that those stations had, usually on Saturday mornings, had like a Elvira or a Dr. Morgus type character. You know what I'm talking about.
In this area, we had WWDC, which is still there. The station is still there, but it was a UFH channel. It was Channel 20, and the character there was, it was Saturday nights. We had a creature feature, which had horror movies. This was the 70s. I'm a little older than Chris. You know, the 70s into the 80s, and it was I can't think of the character's name, but he was a vampire.
Yeah, it's usually a vampire or mad scientist or something in between. Or
and this guy did different characters for that. You know, where he would host different movies, but his big one was a creature feature on Saturday nights because out of that spaghetti western era, and it kind of went right into the cheesy horror.
Yeah, it was always.
Of course, at the time, and you know, the same thing with the spaghetti westerns that you and I like to make fun of now. And personally, I mean, my dad didn't watch it, but when I would go up to Flint in the summers, my grandpa loved westerns. Like you said, John Wayne, obviously.
Yeah.
If there was a John Wayne movie on, you know, we had to watch that. But you know, then the Charles Bronson came out. Clint Eastwood loved Clint. Even television, you know, getting off the movie track with the western, you know, Gunsmoke and The Rifleman, and we had to watch all that stuff. And I didn't think they were cheesy because I didn't know what that was. I didn't know the term, but I didn't like westerns. It wasn't my thing. But I think for the older than our generation, it was everybody wanted to be a cowboy. I mean, because nobody really, they thought that was a great life to live out in the open, no responsibilities, so to speak.
Little rules, you know, that just.
Yes. You know, if somebody pissed you off, you pull out your gun and shoot them between the eyes.
Or you could just run off and don't have to worry about nobody, nothing. And
yeah, you know, your mode of transportation, all you had to do is find some a nice patch of grass and fill up, you know, didn't cost you any money, you know. But then. Then now, you know, you get into what we call now, and you and I like to, I think we affectionately refer to them as the B-movies, the cheesy horror movies of the 70s into the early 80s. But when you think about it, when we watch them now, we think, oh my God, that's terrible. The acting sucks, the writing sucks, the display effects are non-existent. But we didn't know that when those movies.
Or we didn't care.
I honestly think we didn't know it because it was so much better than anything that had been before that. And for those of you who don't know Chris as well as I do, I know he has just a plethora of movies. And here for a while, Michelle and I would borrow movies from him. He brought me some pretty bad movies to watch, but at the time that those movies were made,
I mean, they were.
It was like,
and for a lot of the younger generation, especially some of the Doctor Who fans out there who watched the classic episodes, when they used characters or they called them creatures and they stuck a person in essence in a radioactive protection suit and called it an alien. That's because a good 85% of the public did not know what a radioactive protection suit looked like. So therefore, they could pick up maybe two or three suits on the cheap and use them for an episode and go, ooh, an alien. And therefore, they made a movie for $50.
And that's probably why the spaceships were all flying. They were flying saucers because it was so easy to
glue two dishes together?
Yeah, put a string, and then you just kind of shake the string, and the plate would move. And you just move your arm across the, you know, in front of the camera, and it, like you said, it didn't cost anything, really, because they already had the plates, they already had the string.
Like I said, when I watched Saturday afternoon TV, I call some movies Saturday afternoon TV movies, because it was a perfect fit for that time frame for, you know, a young boy or young child, you know, growing up, and watching Dr. Morgus, and, you know, at that time when I was like maybe about 6-7 years old, my father coming down, he was saying Dr. Morgus. I remember seeing him as a kid, but watching the cheesy sci-fi movies and seeing rocket ship and going, that's no rocket ship, that's a fire extinguisher, and literally seeing two ropes hold it up and it's blowing out smoke, but it's so cheesy, and I'm like, you know, the term train wreck never popped into my skull, but movie wise it's a train wreck, you can't not look away, you know. But as I grew older, you know, you find out more, and
of course now that I have a movie
Soul Train Wreck, which I got Lloyd's fiance over. Lloyd and his fiance went to see the movie a few weeks ago, Train Wreck, and she posted on Facebook, "We're going to see Train Wreck," and I replied back, "I bet you can't look away."
And she said,
"Had a lot of sex."
What the fuck? But you know, with the whole cheesy thing, what we were talking about the last night was with the kung fu movies.
Yeah.
Grew up with, you know, how the you know, person could stand on the ground and, you know, just jump into, you know, air and land on top of a 3-story house. I mean, you can see the rope.
Yeah.
I mean, but you're. I mean, I think part of the thing was pretty, you were supposed to pretend that you couldn't see.
Yeah, there's one movie with Jackie Chan.
There's only one movie with Jackie
Chan? There was one for Jackie Chan's earlier films.
Oh, you're only referring to
a Jackie Chan film. When
you
he
said there was one movie with Jackie Chan.
One of his movies.
Okay.
All he does is touch someone on his upper arm, and the guy just dies.
Can't they really do that?
It wasn't played out to be like that. It was just like, hey, how you doing? And he just on the shoulder and just bad actingly dies. But I remember one of our co-hosts showed me, I had to watch it at his house, the Kung Fu movie had so many jump little editing cuts, they were noticeable, literally noticeable. It was like a blink, an actual blink, like the camera was blinking.
Right.
It wasn't a jump cut, it was just blink, and it was like, I think I'm getting a seizure watching this movie. And he's like, you notice it too? And he's like, yeah. But after a while, but in the 60s, you had people like Roger Corman, Wes Craven, and John Carpenter just come out with movies that started to raise a bar, so to speak, with some aspects of movies. Some directors, some producers set a bar for everybody else. I'm not just talking George Lucas, but and Spielberg, just set a bar.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's how everything goes. I mean, and that's like we're saying, you know, it blends. I mean, somebody comes up with an idea and, you know, hey, and probably one of the most incredible things that anybody ever came up with is, why don't we figure out a way to hide the string? Or the wire, or the big-ass rope, you know? And, you know, it may not have actually been all that difficult. Somebody probably like, that's genius. Nobody ever thought of that. We were just expecting the audience, the viewing audience,
to ignore it.
To pretend it wasn't there. I mean, think about it. They don't hide it when you go to the theater. They can't do that. It's impossible. You know, if you go see a Broadway production of Peter Pan or Mary Poppins, you're going to see the wire. There's no way to hide it. I mean, it's impossible. So, in a play audience, you know, an actual theater audience is expected to pretend they don't see it, or they don't have. Obviously, you got to be careful with the pyrotechnics and fire and things like that. Yeah. So it's up to the audience to pretend they can see it. They have to know when they're pretending to not see something, and when they're supposed to pretend to see something, because you can't have special effects because it's live action in front of you. Whereas in the movies, because of the Wes Cravens and the other guys you mentioned,
George Lucas's,
well,
and Spielberg, and so forth.
But anyway, those guys, they came up with the ideas that, you know, now when you go back and you see a movie where they hadn't thought of that yet, you think, well, this is terrible. No, they just hadn't thought of it yet. I mean, and a lot of times the technology was actually there to do it. I mean, think about it. All the crappy ass science fiction movies you saw after the original Star Wars came out. I mean, I'm not talking about before. I'm talking about all the crappy science fiction you saw after the original Star Wars came out. You're like, wow, you know. And, you know, and that, I guess that's just the way with entertainment. Think of all the crappy cartoons. And I'm talking the animation of them, not the content that they make when they're now. I mean, they actually can. They have animated movies where the characters look pretty damn real. You know.
You're almost talking about like The Simpsons and maybe like a South Park sort of thing.
South Park more than The Simpsons.
We're using them as examples, Michelle. But a lot of people would say, well, when I spoke to a couple of people online about certain aspects like Quentin Tarantino and his style, some might say, you know, leaving certain aspects for the viewing public to talk about and purposely leaving those breadcrumbs saying, what about that character that he put in or he focused in on? And some movie buffs will say, no, Hitchcock did that first. I'm like, well, he might have done that first, but nowadays people understand Tarantino, they understand this director, they understand that director. You have to kind of use a modern day reference, but you have to also, I told people, you also have to understand, since Hitchcock, the viewing audience and the theaters almost changed a little bit. It took someone like Quarantino to say, fuck you, I'm going to do my own style, I'm going to use this influence, I'm going to use that influence, I'm going to do it my way. And obviously, he's a success in doing what he's doing now. So.
I don't understand why, but, you know, he is a success. I mean, people love his stuff. I mean, they do. I mean, it's some of the most popular movies out there. I mean, so many people talk about Pulp Fiction being, like, an American classic. And I'm determined to be one of the few American males to die at an old age and never have seen Pulp Fiction. But that's a discussion for another time. But yeah, I know, you know, what you guys think of George Lucas, you know, or a Spielberg or Steven Spielberg came up with an idea. They were probably told many times, you know, that won't work. People aren't going to go for that. And they basically said, well, you know, then this will probably be the last movie I ever make.
And turns around, it's a hit.
Yeah, now you've got, you know, mega franchise in Star Wars, you know. And had they decided that they wanted to, they probably could have had a mega franchise based on E.T., you know, because it was so popular and so, I mean, it was so well done for the time. And, you know, E.T. comes home, you know, returns, or, you know, let's go visit E.T. at his home, and, you know, E.T. invents the cell phone much better than we have it now, type of deal. And, you know, Drew Barrymore can come out, you know, reprise her role, only maybe show some titties this time, you know. What?
But that's the point I was going to bring up last night, but you said save it for today. And I'll revise it a little bit. Today, with all the sequels and everything else, as soon as you get that one hit that's made for a few million dollars, even today, like a Paranormal Activity or something or Clerks that's made for maybe about $30,000-$40,000 or $500,000, and it just brings in $100 million, $200 million, $300 million, the studios are right there to that person. Want to make a sequel? I'll give you, you know, I'll give you whatever. But back in the late 60s, early 70s, with the original Planet of the Apes series, the first one was, I looked it up this morning, was made for like $5 million, and it made $30 million.
It wasn't $10
million. But the second one, instead of giving them more money, he said, here's $3 million. And it made $15 million. And with the third one, they gave him like $2 million. And it was still a box office. And they would just keep, like, instead of more money, they're like, here's less, here's less, here's less, here's less. Nowadays, it's here's more, here's more, here's more. Which kind of just could almost ruin a film, so to speak. But nowadays they're reaching for every book title, comic title, you know. It's like, ooh, the Virgin series, ooh, Maze Runner series, ooh, Twilight series. Gotta just pick these books up, pick these books. Not so much the hype the books, but we need a trilogy, we need a new trilogy.
Yeah.
It seems like since, not to pick on Lord of the Rings, but since that was a hit with Lord of the Rings and The Hobbit and Harry Potter, they're reaching for other titles to see which one is more of a bank for future.
Right. Yeah, I mean, and now with the emergence, I started to say reemergence, but really, other than a few TV shows, the big emergence of superhero comic book characters being so popular in movies now. I mean, there's no limit to what you can do as far as they go, because what the fuck, Spider-Man has been around for what, 70 years now, you know, 60 years,
something like that.
You know, I'm not exactly sure how old Stan Lee is, but you know,
he's in his, from what I hear, he's in his 90s. So.
Yeah, he's up there.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, people will get attached to an actor maybe playing that role. What's his name? Tobey Maguire.
Yeah.
The first three.
Yeah.
And then, you know, they switched it up and got the other actor. I've actually only seen parts of one of those movies. I haven't even seen a whole one of the second run. And now they're talking about a third run. And what I thought was extremely interesting, the second group of Spider-Man movies, I guess they were the Amazing Spider-Man movies, that it wasn't Mary Jane as Peter Parker's girlfriend.
They went with Gwen yeah. Stacy.
So, you know, there's so, I mean, you got 50 years, 60, we've already established, we don't know how many years for that particular. But any comic book, I mean, I hear Ben Affleck's going to be the next Batman, is what, what I'm being told. And now, you know, granted, like, my cousin Jimmy, he was like, he heard, someone said he's the best Batman ever. It may be, I don't know. I mean, obviously, I have to withhold judgment until I see the movie. But look at the different, you know, people that have played Batman. You know, there's 50, 60 years worth of comic book stories. I mean, and so far they barely even touched the surface of Batman. You know, with Robin, you know, leaving, and what was the other one? That the new sidekick after Robin was Darkwing or something.
What happened was the original Robin grew up.
I know what happened. I'm just saying.
Yeah, it was Darkwing. And
I'm just saying, as far as the movies go, I mean, we've had, you know, the with Michael Keaton is the first Batman, and not in the cheesy 60s Batman movies. I'm talking about the more modern era with Keaton, and then Kilmer and George Clooney. And yet, you know, we don't need to get into discussing who we thought was the best out of those. Christian Bale, you know, did his run. And if Ben Affleck's making a run, I like Ben, unlike a lot of people. I really like Ben Affleck in Daredevil. I mean, I really liked that movie. I mean, I can't say, I wouldn't go as far as saying I loved it, but I really liked the movie. I mean, I thought Ben Affleck did a great job in that. It's with those movies, we already had Robin in the run with Batman and Robin, you know. So, you know, they can just keep making these movies. What I don't understand is, you know.
And right now, you have movies like Guardians of the Galaxy, Avengers, those type of movies hitting the billion-dollar mark. Or the upper tier, the upper triple million.
And I think, like, the Avenger movie made $100 billion before it ever came out. I know that isn't true, but you just think about it. You know, if the next Avengers, if they make another Avengers movie, which they'd be stupid not to try it, if it doesn't clear $200 billion by the end of the second weekend, it's going to be considered a flop.
I know they consider the first Avengers movie hit like $1.6 billion. The second one hit $1.2 billion, and Marvel and Disney considered it a flop.
Yeah.
Because it only hit $1.2 billion. And I'm like, wait a minute, how can you consider one? You made it. It's over $1 billion. You made the movie for maybe $150 million, and it made over $1 billion. You more than made your money back. It's not a flop. If it made $50 million, it's a flop. But it made over $1 billion, so it's not a flop. It granted it didn't make as much as the first one, but it's still a success. Be happy over it. But to go back a little bit on what you were saying about Daredevil and Affleck, as you know, some of the movies that have been out in the past, like Daredevil, that might not have been that good, or the Van Damme version of Street Fighter, I'm sure you've probably seen that. That the movie itself is terrible, but you have actors like, he played in the Addams Family, Gomez Adams in the Addams Family movies. You know what I'm talking about? He sold that. We need you to play this character. He sold his heart out as that character. He became that character. You know what I'm saying? You've seen those characters. They made that movie. They were trying to sell their heart out. Have you seen any movies beside that come to your mind that were like that? That a certain actor or actress sold a movie It would have been a triple A movie.
Yeah, I mean, I've seen them. I mean, nothing comes to mind. But, actors do that all the time. But not, I don't think they do it enough. I mean, but, yeah, you know, if you believe all the stories, Jim Carrey, who, y'all know, not the most talented actor, very talented comedian, but they said he tends to do that with some of his roles. When he played Andy Kaufman in Man in the Moon, they said that the whole time preparing and shooting that movie, you had to refer to him as Mr. Kaufman. He actually reverted into some of Kaufman's known and, at the time, otherwise unknown idiosyncrasies. And for that movie, I guess if he did do it like that, he sold me, because I thought that was a great movie for a Jim Carrey movie. But it was a great movie. I don't think anybody else could have pulled that off.
I'm probably butchering the man's name. Raul Julia.
Oh, Raul Julia.
Yeah. God rest his soul. He passed away good many years ago. He was a great actor. One of great
character actors.
Another great character is Christopher Lloyd. Would you say he could be considered that as well?
I don't think you could consider him anything but. I mean, as far as that goes, Christopher Lloyd. You remember he played the played a Klingon.
Yeah.
On the Search for Spock movie.
Yeah.
And the first, probably half hour of the movie, he, of course, the costume spoke Klingon. I mean, because they were on the Klingon, all the scenes were on the Klingon ship. And I thought, and as far as making a movie, you know, out of a classic, or even a cult classic at the time, you know, like Star Trek.
I'll get it. Excuse me.
Because they were on the Klingon ship, everything was spoken in Klingon.
Yeah.
So until he actually, and I knew I recognized it. I knew I recognized it, but I had no idea who it was. And as soon as he started speaking English to Spock, Captain Kirk, I was like, it's Christopher Lloyd. And for the rest of the movie, all I saw was a Klingon Reverend Jim. I mean, honestly, I mean...
Again, before the younger generation, back in my time, we didn't have IMDb. We had, that guy from that movie, or,
Wikipedia,
or, you know, something like that. It was like, wait a minute, I know that guy. I just seen him last week in this show or that show, or... There's still a crap ton of character actors that they were in a crap ton of movies.
And you know, and for all you youngsters, you know, to this day, even in the IMDb or whatever you just said era, and Wikipedia and everything, we folk of the older generation, a lot of times we have no idea. In which we've obviously proven in this conversation what an actor's name is. We refer to them by the characters of their most popular show, movie, whatever. I mean, we'll refer to, the guy that played George Costanza, or the guy that played Kramer. I mean, the only reason anybody knows who Jerry Seinfeld is because his character's name was his name. Throughout the Reverend Jim, I didn't know Danny DeVito's name until he started doing movies.
Right.
He was a guy, he was Louis from Taxi. I mean, Cliff, Cheers. I mean, most people don't, we didn't know these actors' names. We knew Norm. I mean, you saw George Wendt on anything. You're just Norm.
Yeah.
I mean, he'd be, you know, he'd be playing a serious role. If George Wendt, especially in the late 90s or early 2000s, went and did a Broadway play, a production of Hamlet, he would walk out on the stage, and I guarantee at least a half a dozen people in the audience would go, Norm!
And that's thing, almost the same thing. I remember as a teen watching HBO, there's a B-movie out there called House 2. And it's kind of like a haunted, not so much a scary haunted house, it had a little bit of humor to it. And the guy who inherits the house, having problems with the electrical, he's like, I think I have something wrong with the electrical. You open, the repairman's coming. Doorbell rings, open it up, George Wendt. I'm like, Norm! That's Norm!
Okay. Yeah.
No, it wasn't Norm, it was the postman. It was the
Cliff. Cliff Flavin.
It's like, I know that guy.
You know what, his name right now won't come to mind. You know,
but you know who...
I know Cliff Flavin. I know exactly, you know, he played the pig on in Toy Story.
He's their good... He's
you know, you can talk out loud. I'm sorry.
How big?
But, with, you know, on the same subject, now, one of my favorite actors, if not my, you know, of my actors, Joe Pesci. Love Joe Pesci. And when he broke off the of his norm of gangster movies, you know, playing the wise guys, and did My Cousin Vinny. As soon as he got in the courtroom, he saw the judge. I did not see a judge sitting up in that courtroom.
You saw Herman Munster.
I saw Herman Munster. But, yeah, I mean, that's what we did. And even now, you know, I don't know the name of a lot of actors. I refer to them, even with movies, I refer to them, you know, the dude played in that movie. And I'll give the name of the movie if I can remember. I used to go to the movies a lot. I've been to the movies once in the last probably 10 years. We saw Trainwreck.
I know, I've done
what
it.
What did you think about that movie? It was good. A lot of sex.
Like, I could.
That was funny.
Tell you, like, oh, I could go to a show. Like, I met so and so. Who? So and so. Who? And I'll say, oh, he's this. And he, like I did with, this past.
Oh, she wants your Wi-Fi code.
It's only good for this. Sorry about that. Sean Astin. I told you I met Sean Astin, and you're like, who? Sean Astin? Who? Sam. Oh.
Or, you know, you could have said Rudy.
Or Rudy. You know, he's,
You know, I was just messing with you that day.
Probably were. You know, he's,
He signed your iPad, right?
No, he signed the Lord of the Rings poster. His dad's the original Gomez Adams. So it, the whole history, family history of growing up with one son, him watching his son in the movies and just watching his dad on the reruns, you know what I'm saying, on TV, with the original Addams Family.
Have you seen the Barbershop movies?
Yeah.
You know the guy in the barber, the white guy in the Barbershop movies, that plays, that
yeah.
works in the bar. You know that's Jane Fonda's son.
No.
It's Jane Fonda's son. The white guy in the Barbershop movies is Jane Fonda's son. Have you ever seen, just on the kick of, you know, obviously Goldie Hawn's daughter, everybody knows.
Yeah.
Have you ever seen the television series Rules of Engagement?
Yeah.
Okay. The guy that, of the four, you had the two couples, not the married couple, the other, the two that are engaged. The guy, the actor that plays the guy in the engaged couple, that's Kate Hudson's brother, Goldie Hawn's son, Oliver Hudson. A lot of people didn't know that. It's kind of like, it's an acting bug, and I mean, that's what your parents do. I mean, yeah. Obviously, with Oliver Hudson and Kate Hudson, their mother being the famous Goldie Hawn, and it's not their father, but if you ask them who their father is, they'll say,
yeah, go.
Not their mother, their father.
Kurt Russell.
There you go. I mean, it's almost a given that those kids are going to grow up acting some, or I shouldn't even say act, but be in the industry in some way. It's all they know. Probably all their friends and, you know, the people they know, that's what they do. I mean, and when you see them, you see children of big-time movie stars, especially the product of a marriage of two actors, they tend to go into that business. I mean, obviously, it's a little different with musicians, athletes, things like that, because if your fingers don't work on a guitar, they just don't work on a guitar. I mean, when, you know, obviously, you know, sports is different, but I mean, Drew Barrymore coming from a huge,
you know, line of
actors, or, you know, even like I said, even in that industry, look at Mariel Hemingway. I mean, obviously the most famous Hemingway wasn't an actor, but was an author, you know, so therefore we're entertaining people.
I know we kind of touched on this. I probably touched on it earlier in the show, but we touched on it a little bit last night when we were at Emmanuel's house. The whole aspect of the oh come on in the movie. You touched on it with Twister. I touched on it with in some circles, Marshall Squad, where you have that one instance where you have something that's able to lift up, you know, Jeeps, semis, you know.
Yeah.
The whole aspect, like, a lot of people have spoilers for those who haven't seen the movie. By the way, Darth Vader's Luke Skywalker's father.
Say it.
Chewbacca. Luke, I am your father. What else?
Wait a minute. He was Luke Skywalker's father?
Yeah.
I'm going to have to get around to seeing those movies eventually.
Bruce Willis was dead the whole time.
When did Bruce Willis die?
Sixth Sense. The original Planet of the Apes. He was on Earth the whole time. And by the way, Carrot Top is not that funny. So, in Monster Squad, there's a big...
Oh, wait a minute. They were on Earth the whole time?
On Planet of the Apes, yes.
Who the hell's Carrot Top?
Precisely. But, in Monster Squad, they... near the... That's going to be the loudest part in the whole show.
Checking my notes.
They open up a vortex, and this thing sucks in... Jeeps. pickup trucks, mailboxes, the whole nine yards, and less than 10 feet away is a five-year-old girl hiding behind a park bench, which is not moving.
But it's bolted down.
The park bench is on its back.
One bolt. One bolt.
She's not holding it on. She's just kneeling there. Like, oh, come on. You were talking about Twister, where Twister's picking up, you know, two-ton cows. And
but not the half-ton. Just really good tires. Maybe some really good tires.
You know, Goodyear was probably going, our tires.
Yeah. I'm surprised they didn't come out with, you know, advertising. They probably could have sponsored, been a major sponsor for that movie. You know.
Just walk out, just show the trailer. Instead of saying Twister, Goodyear.
Yeah. Look at the traction on
the tires. Of the whole aspect of Jaws.
Hey,
one shot going out the whole damn freaking family.
And, you know, another thing we talked about last night was the amount of people that get upset over... Well, they get either way. You know, it's something we talked about. That this movie wasn't realistic. Okay? It's a movie. Of course, it's not real. It's a movie. And it wasn't realistic enough. And then that same person will go see another movie and they would say, yeah, it was a little too realistic for me. I mean, there's a line they have to have, you know. And I brought up that if a lot of people look, you know, will be upset because the movie wasn't, you know, realistic enough. Or it was too realistic. But they'll love that movie based on a true story and they have no idea of the facts that they're presenting in the movie that aren't didn't actually happen or happened in a different order or way, you know, because if
of movie drama reasons.
Yeah, well, if you did it exactly the way it happened in real life, it wouldn't have been interesting. I rattle off a few of them. I won't go into all that, but
to kind of quote a case to reference you, a well-known case is with Punisher Warzone. The when they were making that movie, they brought in a panel of fans who literally know Punisher Warzone inside and out. They know the character inside and out. They told the group, what do you want? We want this movie to be as comically accurate as possible so we don't have any fan bitching. They obviously didn't say fan bitching.
No, they probably said fan bitching.
So they gave all the used this group throughout the whole movie. Showed them the finished product, which everybody saw in theaters. He still bitched.
Hey, people were
It was like, wait a minute, we used everything you told us. You signed, in essence, signed off on this. This Marvel signed off on this. And you still bitch. Yeah, it was too much. If we didn't do it all what you said, you would have bitched. It was too little.
Yeah, and you're always going to get that. You can't please everybody. And I don't think they should drop. One time, and this was several years ago. I don't know that it will work now. But they were in talks of producing a Wonder Woman movie.
Yeah.
And at the time, the big holdup was they couldn't. Nobody could come up with the actress that would embody the comic book character Wonder Woman. And the job I had at the time, we were talking about it, and I throw out there, and it was a construction job, to be honest. And I throw out there that, like I said, this is at the time. I said, you know, it would be perfect, Wonder Woman. Beyonce. And, I mean, she's a little bit older now, and I just don't know that it would work now. But at the time, when they did, I couldn't tell you how many years ago it was when they were talking about it. She had just got finished with the Austin Powers movie. So her acting credentials were out there. You know, she's a pretty good actress. She's good looking. She doesn't mind showing a little leg and, you know, cleavage. And she's a tall, muscular woman. And I got so much flack from my buddies at work about the color of her skin. It's got to do with anything. It's a fictional character. I mean, it doesn't really matter what color she is. But people get so caught up in little things, you know. When The Green Mile, Tom Hanks and the big guy.
Michael Clark Duncan.
Yeah, the late Michael
Clark Duncan.
I went and saw that movie. And as an avid reader, not a Stephen King fan. His horror books. Loved The Green Mile, the novel. Coming out of the theater, and there was a lady bitching. They left so much of the book out. I looked at the lady and said, the book was about 900 pages. If they would have put everything in the movie from the book, we'd have been sitting in there for 4 days. Sometimes you just got to cut things out. If they'd have put everything in the Lord of the Rings trilogy,
it would have been.
They would have had to make 10 movies, 12 movies, at least. I mean, but most people don't realize how much they cut out of that because they've never read the books. Otherwise, a lot of people would probably felt the same way about the Hobbit movies that I felt.
Yeah, well, they had to add stuff into the Hobbit to pad it out.
I think they got away in the Hobbit movies. I personally think they got away from the book
too much,
and just made it more of a, you know, happy, let's play to the
fans and
let's play to what the fans think hobbits are and dwarves are. And, you know, it really played up on the whole bickering and everything amongst the dwarves, even though, you know, they're brothers in arms. And, you know, clansmen, everything. You know, they put. Then it got to the last movie, the Battle of the Five Armies. And in the book, basically, Bilbo just describes what happened with the Battle of the Five Armies, and then, you know, how the dwarf characters ended up, you know, later on in life, you know, where they died in the battle, if they died, when they died afterwards, or what have you. Whereas in the movie, they added all that in as action and made it much better. But people get so caught up in whether it's real or not. I mean,
the original Dune movie was like that. Yeah. You had so many. I tried reading.
It's a hard read.
I'm not knocking Lord of the Rings at all.
Lord of the Rings is a tough read, but not near as tough as Dune.
I tried to, because I liked the original Dune movie, so I decided to pick up the set, that garage sales and yard sales, so forth and so on. I barely got through the first 10 pages because I had to go to the end of the book, look up what it was like, almost every other word I had to go to back the book, read what the author tried to mean, and go back, read a few more words, go back. I'm like, no. But when I started to get into Lord of the Rings, I read The Hobbit first, of course. Mm. Made it through that. Still trying to work through my copy of Lord of the Rings, but it's a tough read. But you don't have to go back and forth, back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. So it's...
Yeah, I mean, and there are movies, well, there's, now I saw the first, I don't know if you actually saw Maze Runner.
Yeah, I saw it.
I know you weren't as impressed with it as
no.
I was. But movies like that, now I didn't even know that it was a book until I actually saw it here at the Martinsburg Berkeley County Library. And that's when I realized it was a book. Now I can't read the books until after I've seen all the movies.
Yeah, but with again, going back to Dune, when they made the Sci-Fi Channel series, the fans went, yeah, they had with the original movie. Like, I tried watching the miniseries. I'm like, you know what? Half of what the extended cut of the original movie had, the series left out. And it was like half and half. Like, wait a minute, you bitched about the original movie leaving stuff out, but the series left out, you're not bitching about that. Then shut up.
I don't know which. I don't think I saw much of the series. I enjoyed the movie. I actually liked the book, but it was a hard read. It took me a lot longer to read that book than it does most.
I just found out recently through a celebrity podcast called Nerdist. They had Sir Patrick Stewart on, and he said, because he was in the original movie, he told the host, did you realize that the original Dune was supposed to be a trilogy, but since it in essence flopped at the box office, they said no. And since then they were trying to redo it as a movie, and he said if he's still living, he's willing to step up to the plate and play a part somewhere in it.
Well, hey, Charlton Heston did in Planet of the Apes.
Yeah. But you would have to, like, is that Charles? Nah, they can't. You actually had to look and try to see past the makeup.
I don't know, I picked it up pretty quick. I mean, but it made sense for him to be in it.
Yeah.
I mean, just kind of like how they, but they kind of reversed a lot of that movie. Charlton Heston played
a lot of, like, Michael Clark Duncan was in that. And
yeah,
a lot of good.
He's the one.
You said it. Yeah.
You get your hands on me. You're a filthy, stupid human.
A lot of good actors in that. Again, it was listening to the audio commentary on that for that movie just plain sucked. Literally, it sucked. It turned me off with commentaries. Just hearing Tim Burton just like, I didn't like being on a set because I don't like horses, and we had to use horses every day. That there was just a painting, and that was a little model treat.
Yeah.
I'm like, it was so boring, and I'm like, no, no. And the complete opposite of that was listening to A Knight's Tale commentary and listening to the director, and like, I hate horses, I hate working with horses, I'm afraid of horses, but that horse right there, I loved working with that horse. One take, that's all he needed. It was just fun listening to that director and the producer just talk about what they did, and finding out that one of the scenes, at least in Knight's Tale, it was a goof, but in the production, for those who don't know, in Knight's Tale, at one point, it also stars the late Heath Ledger.
Yeah, Heath
Ledger. One character comes out after the match to kind of hype up Ledger's character, and he was supposed to expect the crowd to applause because it was all filmed in, I think, not Hungary, one of the
Eastern European.
And the whole aspect of them applauding got lost in translation. So one of the American crew that was supposed to be with Heath Ledger just went kind of go, yay, and kind of like nudge the crowd. And then him doing that worked better and more natural for the film than everybody just going, yeah, at the same time. He was like, yeah, that was a goof. Yeah, it fit in so well with the movie. We just used it. And finding out stuff like little hidden gems later, again, using IMDb while watching the movie, mm-hmm. and kind of creating your own commentary. Okay, that didn't know that about the film. Didn't know that about the film.
Yeah, but, it's interesting how watching an interview with Ron Howard, and he was talking about Splash, and how the very beginning of the movie, when Tom Hanks comes into the office, or the warehouse, but comes to work, and he's singing. He's all happy-go-lucky singing, and he goes over and grabs like the whatever fruit it was and starts juggling, and then tosses him over. How that was not the singing part was in the script, but it was not in the script for him to go over and pick up the fruit and start juggling. He just did it because and Tom Hanks said when
they got the dailies back.
You know, when you clip back to Hanks talking about it, he said when he walked into the room, you had gone through the rehearsals, but when he came in during the live shoot, you know, the actual live tape, it just seemed right. The guy's so lucky, I know how to juggle, so it just seemed, you know, just in a good mood, there's the fruit, it would be the right thing to do.
To me, Ron Howard is one of those directors I am not a big fan of, but I respect as a director. Like, he's my the way you feel about Tarantino, I feel about Ron Howard, but I respect Howard as a director, knowing what, even though I still see him as Opie.
Really?
Yeah.
And you went with Opie?
I went with Opie.
Because, see, I don't necessarily see him as Opie. But I still see him as a child actor.
Happy
just
days.
A older child actor.
Happy Days.
Right. Michelle told you the answer. Spoiler alert.
Screw you, Lloyd. But, is it? I'm sure you've known in Lord of the Rings when what's his name kicks the rock, or no, the helmet. I think it was in the second movie, mm-hmm. when they're trying to find the two hobbits,
yeah.
that were taken off. He broke his toe when he hit that helmet. It was the cry in agony. From what I've been seeing, his cry in agony when he goes down to knees. Was him in pain.
I couldn't get into that.
So it was just him kicking the helmet, breaking his toe. It was just like, wait a minute, you broke your toe? Yes, I broke my toe. It fit. Cut, print, go. But the thing is, with a lot of, what's your take on remakes? A lot of the, you know, like 5 years later, 10 years later, then
I don't have a problem with doing it. I mean, there have been some remakes I didn't like. Some remakes that, you know, at the very least equaled the original. But then I've seen some remakes that were probably better than the original. So I think if, you know, because usually with a remake, a lot of people say, oh, they just couldn't come up with a good idea. But they did come up with a good idea. Let's make the first one better. I mean, personally, I prefer the second Longest Yard to the first. And I'm really a big fan of the first, the original, with Burt Reynolds as the lead character, you know. But I felt that they did a better job, you know. Not any, you know, when you think about it, that's not a movie with a lot of special effects, so that had nothing to do with it. I just think the concept of it was better. There's some, you know, remakes that are equal.
Yeah.
You know.
To me, it's a crapshoot, you know,
yeah.
Depending on. But what I've noticed in recent years that a lot of diehard movie fans, that their interest spans across the board, they've gotten so tired of the remakes, the movies based off of books, based off of comics, the sequels, the this and that, that they've went to kind of the independent and the lower budget genre so they can have something more original.
I agree with that, but you know, the only thing with me on that, I mean, most sequels don't equal, in my opinion, most, not all, but when it comes to, you know, people being upset that they're making movies from books, the thing about books is, I love to read, but some people just, you know, they can read. I'm not mm-hmm. just saying that people can't read, they just can't read.
Okay.
You know, they're literate, they're not illiterate, they just, like Michelle just said, she just can't get into it.
I can't remember.
There's the remembering thing. Some people can't paint a mental picture of what they're reading in their mind. Me, I personally do the opposite. I'm able to skim parts of books that I've never read before. I get to a certain part that I know I don't need all that description, and I'll skim over it. So I think they need to make some books into movies. It's not some of them they don't. I've actually seen movies that were so far off. I mean, I ain't talking like they did with The Hobbit. They really went off. They went off of the concept of the book, you know, the actual storyline of the book, but the concept was the same. I actually watched a movie one time. And the movie was half over before I realized that I had read the book about 3 years before that. Same name. But the movie was so different than the book. And then, basically, they had the same characters. And what the characters did, their profession was the same. And that's pretty much
that's it.
I mean, the book was like a suspense drama type of deal. And the movie tried to have a little suspense to it, but it was more comical than... Striptease, by the way. Movie with Demi Moore.
Yeah. Another movie that kind of switched it up a little bit was Hearts in Atlantis. The person who adapted the Stephen King book said, "Here's a book with suspense and a little bit of sci-fi into it, and I can't do that. I have to take a little bit of that element, put it into the movie I'm trying to do, but I have to rely heavily on the drama aspect of it and kind of play to Anthony Hopkins' strengths in that regard." And to me, it worked with the book and the part of the book that the movie relied on.
I don't think I've seen the movie, so I can't comment on that. I read the book. But
it's the first third of it. Is what the movie is literally based on. And instead of it being the guy who adapted that part of the book increased the drama a little bit into it and decreased a little bit of the sci-fi mm-hmm. element that was into it and kind of balanced it out to make it work. I think he did a pretty good job. But what do you think about the kind of the rise of the independence movie makers and those coming into the aspect or trying to make the names for themselves?
I've always kind of liked indie movies.
And the almost the B genre, those trying to independent Like, I know I lent you Elton Key trilogy.
I mean, if you're, you know, movies like that, I mean, they're
trying to break through, you know, their own, do things their own way. And
yeah, I mean, it's so cheesy that, you know, copy.
But there's something there.
Yeah, I mean, granted, like, we watched all the Skeleton Key movies. But, I mean, honestly, I love the first one. I mean, Michelle and I watched that many times.
Again, we're talking about Darkstone, John Johnson, Skeleton Key trilogy, not the Kate Hudson one. There is a difference. You could always go to darkstone.ent on the web or do a search for John Johnson's Skeleton Key, and you'll find the DVDs that are probably still being sold somewhere. I'll give him a shout out because those are one of his most well-known movies that he's come out with, and his most, I'd say his funniest. But what, to go back a little bit with Tarantino, with like people like Tarantino, Robert Rodriguez saying, hey, we didn't necessarily pave the way. It's Robert Rodriguez that said it. He said, me and Tarantino kind of opened the door for people like Kevin Smith and the other independents to say, hey, if we can do this, you can do this. Come on, do it. Just do your thing. If you got that passion, do the drive, stick with it. And
yeah, I mean, but think about it. If Mel Brooks were allowed today and wanted to make a movie, he had to go the independent route. Because there's no way a major movie studio is going to pick up anything that blatantly racist. Because all they're going to hear are a few words and phrases. They're not going to look overall how it was anti-racist as opposed to being racist.
Or making fun of the fact of a stereotype, or
a lot of people don't understand that about Mel Brooks. He makes fun of everybody in the movie. Everybody.
Yeah.
So, I mean,
nowadays he can make a what would be considered anti-Semitic joke, and he'd be like, "Wait a minute, I'm Jewish, you know? I'm making fun of myself. I'm the one that actually wrote the script, I'm the one that said it. Why are you saying I'm anti-Semitic? I'm the one that made the joke." So, even...
Actually, I think I've heard people refer to Mel Brooks as anti-Semitic. I have heard people refer to him as anti-Semitic before. I'm like, maybe you realize he's Jewish. Kind of hard to be anti yourself. I mean, well, I guess it can be.
Even Kevin Smith has said that too. Like, when a lot of people approached him, like, we don't like your
gay
references. All, and his reply is, you know, my brother is gay, right? I ran the script by him, and he laughed his ass off. If he didn't laugh his ass off, I wouldn't have probably put this in the movies. And to kind of reference John Johnson and Skeleton Key in his third Skeleton Key movie, he has a whole song about one of the a pirate character being gay, and the song is "I'm a Butt Pirate," and there's a vampire leprechaun in the movie. In real life, that actor is gay, and he was like, "Wait a minute." He turned, literally asked him, like, is this okay with you? And he's like, a pirate that's gay, seeing that he's actually a butt pirate, I find that hysterical. Leave it in. So he's like, hey, gay guy told me it's okay. He liked it. He laughed. He's dancing to it. Leave it in. So,
it's like anything else. Somebody's
going to get offended.
No matter what you do, somebody's going to be offended.
Someone's going to...
You know, somebody's going to not like it. You know, somebody's going to love it. So one person's going to say, it's nothing like the book. And the next person you talk to is going to say, man, it followed the book to a T. So what do? You just make the movie. You know, you make the movie, take a chance. If you've got the support to make that first movie, you know, people are willing to give you the money to make that first movie, make it. And, you know what, go from there. I mean, Tarantino didn't know his first movie was going to produce a second movie. You know, George Lucas had no idea that his vision of six movies,
soon to be more,
that his vision of six movies,
yeah, was going to be so huge.
Well, I mean, because think about it, his vision of six movies not shot in chronological order, or released even in chronological. He didn't have any idea what was going to be. He probably, when he made Star Wars, thought, I better make it good because there's no way the other five are probably going to get made. And, here you are, you're the seventh one's on its way. You know, and people were stoked about it. I mean,
if it doesn't hit, again, $1 billion, it's...
You know what,
it's going to be...
That thing that, you know, and I kind of joked around with the Avengers. The seventh Star Wars movie can possibly make $1 billion before it's released.
It's coming out in December. It'll probably make that before the end of the year.
Yeah, I mean, it can literally... they've marketed Star Wars perfect since its inception. Marketed correctly, that movie, and I'm not talking about just movie ticket sales.
That merchandising
will make $1 billion before it's released. So you can imagine, you know, worldwide, that there's no way that's not going to be the all-time movie. I mean, ticket sales wise, there's no way. And there's no way George Lucas ever thought it was going to go this far.
And I'm going to... We're not running out of time in reference to audio. We're running out of, in essence, studio time because we got started late and room shuffled a little bit. And we don't want to hold up the people that might be waiting for this room after us like the people did before us. So we're going to cut it off now. I'd like to thank Lloyd for being on the show again.
Not a problem.
And Michelle being on the background, quiet as usual.
You said thank you, baby.
You're welcome.
So, as always, if you have any disagreements in reference to what either me or Lloyd has said, I know Lloyd doesn't give a flying fuck, or a crawling fuck for that matter. I'm sure he'd also be the first person to hand you a shovel to find his fucks. Reference to that. But if you do want to write in and complain, our email is longcoatmafia@gmail.com. We are available on Stitcher and on iTunes if you found us through the website. Also, our website is the Long Coat Mafia Podcast. Damn this freaking cold. It's thelongcoatmafia.podbean.com. And our Twitter is longcoatmafia. And y'all have a good episode. And I'll probably be dropping this in a few minutes. Thank you.